I don't think from a ratings perspective or a cha-ching dollar perspective, it makes all that much sense. It's a political decision.
Instead of a second debate, we got two networks airing dueling town halls. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Pollsters took a lot of heat in 2016 when their models predicted a Trump loss, and it's making them a bit defensive this time around.
So in the long run, you know, Biden should win 7 out of 8 times. You know, I know we'll probably get more crap if the 1 out of 8 times comes up, but I can't do anything about that. I think it's the right forecast.
Also, a walkie-talkie-like app that works as a recruitment tool for right-wing militias.
It's us or tyranny, it's us or failure, it's us or a post-American world. And are you all in, over?
I ain't got nothing holding me back, Chris. If it kills me, it kills me.
It's all coming up after this.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
So before we get to the show, I want to tell you about some brand new and oh so timely On the Media swag. Yep, it's that time of year when we remind you how much you need us. And of course, how much we need you. Sometimes we entice you to show your support by hoisting an On the Media mug or over your shoulder with an OTM tote. But these are uniquely expressive times, wouldn't you say? So now we're asking you to literally put your money where your mouth is with an On the Media branded face mask. We really do need your support so that we can keep digging into the stories behind the stories to track how they transform us and the world, so we aren't always surprised. Big stakes, right? That's why we want to keep going. And yeah, we want you to keep going too. So let us gift you with a breathable cotton mask and wear it. For $8 a month, you get one, but for $10 a month, you get two. So even when one is in the wash, you still have On the Media on your face. Just text OTM to 70101, and I'll text you back with a link where you can make a quick donation. Or visit onthemedia.org and click on Donate. Thanks.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Thursday night, dueling town halls. One likened, by a Trump senior advisor no less, to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Mr. Vice President, if you lose, what will that say to you about where America is today?
Well, it could say that I'm a lousy candidate and I didn't do a good job.
The other town hall, more like shootout at the OK Corral.
Now, why would you send a lie like that to your followers? You retweeted
it. That was a retweet. That was an opinion of somebody, and that was a retweet. I'll put it out there. People can decide for themselves.
I don't take a position. You're not like someone's crazy uncle.
The Joe Biden event was on ABC, the president's on NBC, airing simultaneously after the president rejected the idea of a virtual matchup.
No, I'm not going to waste my time on a virtual debate. That's not what debating's all about. You sit behind a computer and do a debate. It's ridiculous. And then they cut you off whenever they want.
In that interview on Fox Business, he talked about how he'd easily won the previous debate, but was energetically lowering expectations for the Greenville, North Carolina town hall for NBC.
So, you know, I'm being set up tonight, right? So I'm doing this town hall with Comcast, C-O-N, right? Con. And then it's NBC, the worst.
So he's participating out of charity? Courageousness such as the world has never known? Or...
So they asked me if I do it, and I figured, what the hell, we get a free hour on television.
But enough of Buck Rogers and Mr. Rogers. Let's talk about NBC going along with the president's demand to counter-program his town hall with Biden's. It seems so unnecessary, venal even. Though NBC's Savannah Guthrie's tough grilling may have blunted some of the criticism after the fact, was this all because the president is and will always be a ratings magnet? Because ABC is saying Biden won that fight this week. According to Jay Rosen, who teaches journalism at NYU and is the founder of the blog PressThink, it wasn't about the ratings.
Would it be smart for the NBA to run Game 6 of the NBA Finals against Monday Night Football for ratings? It doesn't make any sense. They wanted to show Donald Trump they could play ball.
So why did they want to show Donald Trump that they would play ball?
We've seen a lot of small signs that NBC is concerned about its reputation leaning to left, coming from the opinion hosts in MSNBC's primetime lineup. That's partly what the hiring of Shep Smith is about, the emphasis that his show will be straight down the middle. Executives at NBC want to assure Donald Trump that they are still even-handed.
What does even-handed mean in this formulation?
Well, I'm not saying they have a compelling or intellectually coherent view of that. This is a case where decision-making by executives has caused a great deal of anger and resentment in NBC staff. I mean, last night on MSNBC, Chris Hayes and Rachel Maddow were rolling their eyes about NBC's decision. Maddow asked Kamala Harris,
"Are you as mad as everybody else is that NBC is doing a town hall with President Trump tomorrow instead of the debate at the same time that Vice President Biden's going to be on ABC?"
Every year we talk about what's wrong with election coverage. Too much horse race, too little about the issues, clinging to the narratives about the candidates supplied generally by their opponents. Have the conventions of political journalism changed at all since 2016?
Yeah, at the margins, there are some changes. I think there's a little more caution about predicting the race, a little bit more focus on social media spending and foreign interference. But the fundamentals of the coverage hasn't changed at all. You know, we're trying to game out how the race will wind up. There's an emphasis on strategy, and the role of the journalist is sort of to chronicle who's ahead and why they're ahead. That hasn't changed at all, even though journalists are constantly reporting that this presidential election is unlike every other because of the pandemic and the incredible damage to the country happening at the same time. And therefore, the campaign story, the pandemic story can't really be separated. And in that sense, it's not like any other election cycle.
Mm. This week, you were part of a group of political scientists and scholars who released a manifesto. It was called Election Coverage and Democracy Network. And one of its main points is to make the voter the protagonist of election stories.
Voters struggling to get their concerns addressed by the candidates and also struggling with the simple act of voting should be the central character in the narrative for election coverage. And I have advocated for a long time a completely different model of election coverage called the Citizens Agenda model, in which rather than starting with the candidates and their struggle to win, you start by asking the people you are trying to inform, what do you want the candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? What do you want this campaign to be about? And if journalists could begin their election coverage with a very solid inquiry into that question, they could develop a list of priorities coming from the voters.
That didn't include questions like, your opponent says you broil puppies. What do you say to that?
And those kinds of questions, sometimes called gotcha questions, are part of a larger style of journalism. I call it the savvy style, in which journalists perform for us as insiders who know how the political game is played. They're trying to anticipate what sorts of controversies could affect the outcome. My basic rule for understanding press performance during the age of Donald Trump is that the routines of journalists are built on assumptions about how candidates will behave, and Trump violates all those assumptions, and so the routines break and the practices break, and they don't want to reinvent their routines, so they sort of keep on with the tools they have, and they don't apply to Donald Trump. And one of the best examples of that is the whole notion of a gaffe. a candidate lets something really damaging slip from his or her tongue, and it becomes a controversy and distracts from what the candidate's trying to accomplish, the entire presidency of Donald Trump is a gaffe. It's a 20 times a day gaffe. And so to even use that term with Biden, which the campaign press did earlier in the year, talking about his gaffes, is kind of crazy. There's something lunatic about it. But it's an example of clinging to your practices after the premises underneath them have fallen through.
You called on news organizations to switch to an emergency setting. And that meant, among other things, not to cover live any speech, rally, or press conference involving the president because the risk of passing along bad information was too great.
By pushing the emergency button, you allow different rules to come into play for an exceptional situation. And when the president of the United States is the most potent force for misinforming the American public about a public health emergency, you have a civic emergency. And so I try to game out what would the rules look like for Trump coverage. One of them is don't take any of his virus briefings live. Instead, watch them on television. If he makes news, report it. If he doesn't, don't. Fact check everything he says before you pass it along. It's not a question of censoring the president or making it impossible for people to listen to him if they want to. We know that state TV, Fox News is going to carry it. It's always on C-SPAN, whitehouse.gov, YouTube. You can find it, right? Yes, if it's a politically significant lie that has some sort of cultural valence or breaks new ground in presidential line, then maybe you decide to do that.
But you're saying if it doesn't, then a responsible network might decline to cover it.
Absolutely. It's called news judgment. It's one of the basic principles of journalism, right?
But there is this reflex and this tradition that says anything the president says is news.
Yeah, absolutely. What the president says is news is an example of a practice based on a premise that presidents don't waste the podium. They don't just talk without thinking about what they're saying. They don't lie constantly from the perch of the presidency. Trump doesn't obey any of those principles. And so if you continue to say what the president says is news, you open yourself up to a new kind of propaganda method, which Steve Bannon described as flooding the zone with and in the Russian context is called the fire hose of falsehood. You flood every platform and every delivery device with your voice. You don't care if it's true or not. You multiply the number of arguments that you make, and you don't care if there's contradiction between them, because the purpose of the fire hose of falsehood is not to convince anyone, it's to confuse and dismay people and drive them from the public arena. So if you continue on with what the president says is news, you are pursuing a broken practice and a busted premise.
So we should be asking ourselves, you say, is this thing that he said something we should be amplifying?
Correct.
For instance, this week in Iowa, he was basically with his hands swatting away the story of Iowa floods, saying the media was covering Iowa floods and not covering my Nobel Peace Prize nomination.
The networks and most of the news didn't cover it. Could you imagine?
I mean, it reveals something about his character, something that most people would already know. What should we do with that?
President Trump has hacked the newsworthiness formula. There's like criteria that makes something news. In most mainstream newsrooms, if it was never done before, if it was never said before, if it's conflict, if it involves a celebrity, if it's very consequential for lots of people, if it contradicts our expectations. And in the traditional newsworthiness formula, Donald Trump makes news every time he opens his mouth. And so if you continue to follow that formula, you are going to sooner or later, start collaborating with him in his fire hose of falsehood style. And that's why you can't keep them getting sucked into Trump's agenda without an agenda of your own. You have to have something you're trying to defend. Now, what is that thing? Because journalists are taught not to have agendas. One is standing up for a public debate in which the candidates start with a common world of fact and tell us what they're going to do about those facts. If Trump is behaving within that frame, then what he's saying is worth amplifying. If he's trying to bust out of that, then we have to ask ourselves different questions. Another agenda you could have is standing up for free and fair elections. That could become like a cause the newsroom is pursuing through its journalism. A third would be the right for people to participate, that voting is a good thing. And we're going to do everything we can as a newsroom to make that easier, to protect the integrity of the vote, etc. They have to decide what they're for in the age of Hurricane Trump, or they will get blown away.
One thing that seems easy, though, is deplatforming. You can curb misinformation by kicking certain outlets off of social media networks, for instance. Supporters of the QAnon conspiracy theory are finding it harder to congregate on Twitter and Facebook now. This week, Facebook and Twitter restricted the reach of entirely unsupported New York Post screed against Hunter Biden. Is there any way that could be applied to the president?
You can't make decisions like that. Should we stick a label on this thing, the president said? Should we simply take it down? Unless you know what you're trying to protect.
Which brings us to a point you've made for decades, that you have to declare your values. There's a great risk in that because the consensus on what is good and what is right is a moving target. I mean, once slavery was debatable, but you can't have news without a value system.
And most journalists know that when they go into journalism, as their careers unfold, they learn the value of something I call the view from nowhere. The illusion that by advertising your viewlessness, you are somehow becoming more trustable. In the age of Donald Trump, it's pretty easy to see how the view from nowhere opens you up to manipulation. And so eventually, if you want to improve your coverage, you have to ask yourself, what are you for? What are you trying to defend? And especially now in 2020, when American democracy itself is under attack, asking that question is vital to doing journalism at all. And I want to say one more thing here. Whether Trump wins or loses, the American press is in for a confrontation with the view from nowhere for this reason. The Republican Party has become a minority party. And just as it can only win if it makes voting harder, it can only prosper if it makes understanding the party harder. Because if it stands for what it believes in, it will never win elections. And so the conflict with journalism is structural. The American press is in for a confrontation with a Republican Party that can only win elections by obscuring the truth about itself. And it can delay this confrontation, it can deny it, it can claim not to see it, but eventually there's going to be a crash.
Jay, thank you very much.
All right.
Jay Rosen teaches journalism at New York University. His bracing and clarifying observations can be found at pressthink.org.
Up next, the maddening metaphysics of metadata from polling's most prominent proponent, meaning Nate Silver's still splaining.
This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Nate Silver, founder and editor-in-chief of 538.com, never claimed to be an oracle. But after his prescient 2012 forecast of an Obama victory, he was instantly anointed. Here's Jon Stewart.
Nate Silver, Lord and God of the algorithm.
4 years later, the oracling racket got a little harder. The 538 model, based on an amalgam of polls across the country, predicted a 70% chance of Hillary Clinton winning, which was probability, like a 70% chance for a cloudless day. But what hit was in the 30%, a violent thunderstorm, and Silver has spent 4 years explaining that the forecast itself wasn't wrong. That's because the public, especially the Democratic public, had interpreted the 70-30 ratio as a near certainty. And in their disappointment, they blamed the polls.
There's a lot of distrust when it comes to polling out there. After all, Donald Trump did win the election.
Well, here we go again. Silver has adjusted his methodology based mainly on unique circumstances, but the model remains the model. Nate, welcome back to OTM.
Hey, how are you?
Splendid, thank you. So in 2016, when Trump beat the odds, a lot of people wanted to run you out of Dodge.
Yeah.
You have stood by the model, but also tinkered at the margins. In what ways?
Well, I would say that our forecast did a great job in 2016, because there are very few people that gave Trump a 30% chance. And 30% is kind of a lot. It's like a good Major League Baseball player getting a base hit. So I don't think there's anything about our model that would intrinsically have necessitated a change in 2016, except we do have a global pandemic. We have uncertainty about how people are voting, where many people are voting by mail for the first time. We have some of the worst economic data that we've had in the history of the country. We have all types of crazy news stories developing. We had a Supreme Court justice die, another one being nominated. We had the president himself get COVID. So our model does try to account for the extra uncertainty in this election. And as a result, it winds up being a bit more conservative relative to how it might have been in a more quote-unquote normal year.
A lot of the grief in 2016 had less to do with your forecast than partisan expectations and polling illiteracy. What are you doing in 2020 to manage public and especially media understanding and expectations?
One thing I think is we don't foreground the probabilities as much, right? You can see them, right? But if you actually click on 538, the forecast, you see a bunch of different maps simulating different worlds that the election could turn out to be, and there's verbiage, and then you have to kind of scroll down to see the numbers, right? Because one thing about, like, numbers is once you put a number in front of somebody, then they kind of stop seeing anything else or thinking about anything else. We want to provide the context for people and for them to understand where the uncertainty comes from, something about what we're simulating and what we're not. It's important, by the way, to note that, like, our model does make some assumptions, and one important assumption is that all votes are counted and that the Electoral College respects a popular vote in each state. And those things are not certainties. So if there's an attempt to steal the election, that would be outside the scope of our model.
What else are you doing to change your presentation?
Part of it is the messaging that we have when we're doing media interviews like this or going on Twitter, right? It's kind of a matter of tonally how people interpret things. In some ways, though, it's a little easier after 2016 that people have a visceral experience with the lower number coming up. And so people don't need as much persuasion as they might have to take stuff seriously.
First time, shame on you. Second time, shame on me.
Yeah. So one thing about sports fans, right? Sports fans don't tend to get mad at you if your model says, oh, there's only a 13% chance that the New York Giants win this football game and they win, right? Because they've seen enough games where they've seen 13% chances come up all the time. Now, if you get down to 1% or something, you know, the Atlanta Falcons blowing a Super Bowl, it might be different. But people are used to dealing with probabilities when it affects things they have to deal with every day. When it seems like something abstract, then maybe they don't grok it as much. But we're trying to de-abstract what we're saying, I guess, right? And make people understand that, like, look, even if Trump's chances go down to 5%, well, 5% is fairly high when you're talking about potentially a world-changing and a life-changing outcome.
We are speaking on Thursday, October 15th. With less than 3 weeks to Election Day, what does your data forecast for the presidential race?
So as of this very moment, it has Trump with a 13% chance of winning the Electoral College and Biden with an 87% chance. So it's about 1 in 7. Let's say we round that up to 1 in 6 for Trump. You can kind of think of it as a game of Russian roulette, where 1 out of 6 times the chamber comes up where Trump would win. So he's far from out of the running. At the same time, there's not really a precedent for a candidate overcoming this large a deficit this late in the race. You can maybe go back to Dewey versus Truman in 1948, where Dewey was ahead by about 5 points over Truman and Truman won. In this case, Trump's down by more than that. So mathematically, our model thinks it's possible that he could win, but we're running out of historical precedents that are favorable for him. So in some sense, I think given how light Biden's lead in the polls is, I hope people can look at 13% and say, hey, that's not a sure thing. At the same time, this is not one of the more competitive elections that we've seen, at least based on if the polls are right, obviously.
To use the football analogy the New York Times embraced last time around, Biden is looking at a very short field goal. But as you said, these are unprecedented times. What could happen between now and November 3rd to make him to miss that little chip shot?
Well, this in some sense is where it gets harder, right? It's kind of one reason why I like to stick to the mathematical modeling is like, it's hard for me to come up with a narrative by which Trump comes back. But there are a couple of things. Maybe some big pharma company announces progress on a COVID vaccine. You won't get people vaccinated, but that might make people feel a bit more optimistic. Maybe there's a stimulus package that gets some money in voters' hands before the election. Again, that's looking a bit less likely. But I should say, by the way, one crazy thing that could happen is that what if one of the Democrats were to get COVID? There were people in Kamala Harris's orbit who were diagnosed with COVID. They are doing campaign events too. And so that's something that could happen. But it's hard to know. I mean, I think Trump seems to be doubling down on all the strategies that put him 10 points behind to begin with. And so instead of pivoting, he's repeating a lot of very unpopular messaging on COVID, for example. Actually, most voters favor precautions on COVID. There's a myth of Trump as being this masterful campaigner that I don't know is really borne out. I think he was very clever in how he won the GOP primary, but he just barely beat Hillary Clinton. His party lost a ton of seats in the House in the midterms in 2018. And now, if polls are right, we keep using that phrase, he's in a lot of trouble in 2020. And so I'm not so sure that Trump's instincts are as good as sometimes they're made out to be.
You mentioned that football fans have somehow managed to internalize on any given Sunday. And, you know, maybe the New York Giants could trounce the Kansas City Chiefs. Is it a good thing that people have learned that the polls are not an absolute prediction?
Yeah, I mean, they never were an absolute prediction. Polls have not gotten any less accurate or any more accurate for that matter over the long run. And Clinton lost despite only a fairly normal small polling error because she was not that far ahead in the first place. So yeah, people I hope would internalize the lesson that if a candidate is only a couple of points ahead in the polls, then they're going to lose, not half the time, less than half the time, but fairly often. Again, this race is different in that Biden is more than a couple of points ahead. You'd have to have maybe twice the polling error that you had in 2016 for Biden to lose, and that can happen. But now we're getting a little bit more out on the tail of the probability distribution. But polls are always imperfect instruments, for sure.
Look, I'm obliged to observe that after 2016, first you got dumped on for somehow misleading the entire world about Hillary Clinton's chances. Then, when you did interviews saying approximately what you have said today, you got dumped on for being a defensive jerk, I think, as you put it. The conversation we're having now, is this a way of inoculating you and 538 against, you know, whatever outcome we should see on November 3rd?
It's not a strategy at all. It's just me being honest. You know, was it Mark Twain or whatever said? If you're just honest, you don't have to worry about kind of saying the wrong thing. The honest truth is that Joe Biden is way, way ahead in polls. I don't conduct those polls, but I think it's pretty reasonable to think that given where the country is at, that Joe Biden would have a lead given things people are going through and how many people have died of COVID empirically. Could the polls be wrong enough for Trump to win? Yes, it's not likely, but it's hardly unfathomable. So, you know, I have to give people the best information that I can. And I would love to hedge more. I'd love to say, oh, it's 60-40. We don't know who's going to win, right? But that wouldn't be honest. And that wouldn't be responsible given what the data showed. So in the long run, you know, Biden should win 7 out of 8 times. You know, I know we'll probably get more crap if the 1 out of 8 times comes up, but I can't do anything about that. I think it's the right forecast.
Nate, thank you so much.
Definitely. Thank you.
Nate Silver is the founder and editor of 538.com and author of The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. I just want to point out that I was never mad at you. I understand how the weather forecast works.
I appreciate it. It was a good interview, though.
Coming up, an app that offers a haven for the convenient recruitment of online militias.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. With 14 so-called militiamen charged within the past 2 weeks in a kidnap plot against Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, it has not been difficult to make certain critical connections.
Stand back and stand by, but I'll tell you what.
Stand back and stand by, he told them. Hate groups heard the president's words not as a rebuke, but as a rallying cry, as a call to action.
That was Whitmer, and yes, there has been action. Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer Militia inciting violence in Portland, the neo-Nazi Adam Waffen Division, now rebranded as the National Socialist Order, linked to 5 murders, alleged teen shooter Kyle Rittenhouse, unaffiliated but taking up arms with militiamen in Kenosha, Wisconsin. This week, secret tapes surfaced of a neo-Nazi group calling itself The Base, planning recruitment of current and former military. All with dog whistles, retweets, and sometimes direct incitement from the president. So, yes, easy to connect those dots. In a moment, we will look at how these groups themselves connect to fellow travelers and just among themselves. But first, let's consider yet a third kind of connection. The language we use to put a name to the various activities and pathologies on the violent far right. What these locked and loaded paramilitaries call themselves is militias, and that term has taken hold in the media, to Gretchen Whitmer's great chagrin. They're not militias, she tweeted this week. They're domestic terrorists endangering and intimidating their fellow Americans. University at Albany professor Sam Jackson, who studies anti-government extremism, agrees that whatever the Wolverine Watchmen are, it sure isn't the militias our founders envisioned in the Constitution.
It seems that those who wrote the Constitution had this clear idea that there would be a standing military, and then there would be this militia force, which was organized by the states, and the federal government had the authority under certain conditions to temporarily take control of those militia units.
Kind of like what is now the Army National Guard.
Exactly. Over the course of a number of decades, what was originally described as the militia through a series of incremental changes in law became the National Guard.
But what has sprung up over the past 30 or 40 years sure isn't that. These are unregulated paramilitaries, not only independent of government, but often hostile to government.
Exactly. These are people who have adopted the label of militia, pointing back to those founding documents, in order to legitimize their paramilitary activity.
Yeah, they called themselves militias. Did the press just get suckered into accepting this constitutionally memorialized term?
I don't know if I would go that far. I think it's reasonable for the media and for other observers to use labels that these types of actors create for themselves, as long as the use of those labels comes with an explanation of what they mean and how they're being used.
On the other hand, there are other words that do convey so much more. Vigilante comes to mind.
When I think of vigilantes, I think of Wild West frontier towns, posses taking it upon themselves to enforce the law. And while it may be true that some of these actors, like those who are accused in Michigan in this plot to kidnap the governor, while it may be true that they think of themselves as trying to enforce the law, I think that vigilante maybe gives a little bit too much credence to that.
And just terrorist?
Because of how language works, we label acts as terrorism, and then we sort of adopt that same label to describe people who commit those acts. There's a little bit of potential confusion there, though, because if someone lies one time, do we call that person a liar, or do they need to have a habit of lying before we call them a liar? Does someone need to commit an act of terrorism to be a terrorist? Do they need to just plot an act of terrorism? Do they just need to express admiration for or support for an act of terrorism?
Strictly speaking, terrorism is political violence that is committed in order to focus attention on the cause. So an assassination, for example, isn't necessarily terrorism, but something designed to terrorize the public at large, for sure. Do you know where these Michigan guys fall in?
The question is, would the kidnapping be an attempt to communicate to other people involved in government, hey, this fate will happen to you as well if you also engage in similar sorts of activity, or if they were much more instrumentally just thinking, this governor is a problem, therefore we will kidnap this one person?
Can you give me a roster of the most prominent militia organizations?
I'll offer a caveat before I do that, though, which is I tend to think of this as a movement rather than focusing in on groups. When scholars talk about movements, we often think about coalitions that are united by similar ideas or similar goals. The difference between that and an organization or a group is that groups have relatively clear boundaries about who is a member versus not a member. But social movement scholars, for example, would talk about a social movement as being made up of multiple groups and independent actors who are working together to promote similar goals. I do want to push back a little bit on something, which is that some of these militia groups are explicitly white supremacist. And I think that that is by and large not true. In the 90s and in the historical predecessors of these militia groups, there was more explicit racism. But as we saw the second wave of this movement emerge in 2008 or so, we really saw a rejection of racism. And this is not, oh, I'm a white nationalist, not a white supremacist. This is people who are prominent and important within the movement saying, we reject racism, full stop.
Such as the Oath Keepers.
Exactly. So Oath Keepers is a really prominent group within this movement now. Oath Keepers formed in 2009, and they actually went through the trouble of writing up formal bylaws for their organization. And one of the clauses in their bylaws is that they prohibit anyone who has ever previously been affiliated with a racist organization from joining their group. And in fact, the president and founder of Oath Keepers, when people ask him this question, his response is always, I'm a quarter Mexican, how could I possibly be racist? Now, this is a little bit more complicated, of course, than these actors would like to portray it, because there is still bigotry within their ranks. They would say, we're not opposed to all immigrants, we're opposed to those who come in the wrong way. We're not opposed to all Muslims, we're opposed to radical Muslims. That distinction breaks down a little bit when you look at their actual actions. However, I think it's really important to recognize that white supremacist groups, organizations, and movements perceive a racial identity and they organize around that racial identity. For those in militia groups, the identity that they're organizing around is a patriotic one or a nationalist one, not a racial one.
Except when it isn't. Tell me about the Boogaloo movement.
Boogaloo fundamentally refers to this idea that America is soon to face a second civil war. It refers to this internet meme of anytime you're describing the second version of something, you call it the thing to Electric Boogaloo, referencing this awful 1980s movie. So for the Boogaloo, folks, they think that soon we're going to see Civil War II electric boogaloo. What gets complicated is there are anti-government elements that are explicitly organized around that anti-government stance, and others who are explicitly organized around a sense that this second civil war that's coming, this will be the race war that we've been anticipating for so long.
What about the three percenters? We've discussed them on the show. Where do they fit into this ecosystem?
Within the Patriot Militia movement, the second wave that began in 2008, there are two dominant factions. One is Oath Keepers, and the second is Three Percenters. Unlike Oath Keepers, Three Percenters is not a formal organization with clear membership lists or anything like that. Instead, Three Percenters refers to this dubious notion that 3% of those who lived in the British colonies in the late 18th century fought back against the British and won America's independence. And people who adopt this language believe that if 3% of Americans today resist the tyrannical government, they can also defeat tyranny. What we saw was this language around 3%ers emerged around the 2008 point, and people around the country started adopting that rhetoric, and the related symbol, the Roman numerals 3 surrounded by a circle of stars. And these different organizations that have incorporated 3%ers into their name in some way don't necessarily have any relationship with other groups that have 3%ers in their name. And in fact, there have been some, call them internecine squabbles between different actors who adopt 3%ers rhetoric and symbols.
3% is 10 million people in the United States. We're not at that threshold, are we?
No, although the gentleman who came up with the idea of the 3%ers, his name is Mike Vanderbo, he used to say, we only need 3% of gun owners. And there are 100 million gun owners in America, so that's 3 million people. What is an uncomfortable coincidence, I hope, people who study gun ownership in America have found that 3% of gun owners own something like 50% of all of the guns held in private hands in America.
Oh, sweet mother of God, I hope those are different 3%.
I really hope that it's a very unfortunate coincidence.
Sam, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Sam Jackson is a professor of emergency preparedness, homeland security, and cybersecurity at the University at Albany.
As we slouch toward November 3rd, the fear of organized political violence looms large. But how exactly do such vigilantes or militiamen, white nationalists, terrorists, call them what you will, organize, mobilize, and coordinate their activities? How can they be deterred? On the Media Reporter, Micah Loewinger revisits the communications app far-right groups use to fight the fight.
It looks like we are going into the fray tonight, so keep us in your prayers. I just left 2 voice messages, one from my father and one from my wife.
This is a militia member speaking on a walkie-talkie app called Zello.
If I should fall, I want to be remembered as a patriot. Let history show that I stood up against this tyranny. But I'm not going to fall because I'm a warrior and I'm going to kick some ass.
He was psyching himself up before a showdown with Antifa that never happened. I ran across many other violent fantasies like this while monitoring militia groups on Zello. But the app is better known for other things, like communication by overnight truckers, activists in Venezuela, and humanitarian aid efforts.
Basically, the way that it works is people join a chat room and you push a button to talk. And when you release the button and you're done talking, it cuts your mic again.
That's Hampton Stahl, an Atlanta-based researcher and founder of a blog called Militia Watch. We teamed up on this story when we learned we shared a strong interest in tracking far-right activity on Zello.
There's like a little bit of a fetishization of ham radio operation in the armed militia right. The difference between ham radio and Zello is that Zello allows for very fast audio communication between a pretty good amount of people across any distance, as long as people have connection to either wireless or cellular internet.
Another difference is that Zello records and saves everything that's said. Users can also set a password and decide who's allowed to talk. Some militias, we found, operate several Zello channels at the same time, one for interviewing new recruits, one for leaders to discuss operations, one for training in the woods, and another for sharing intel and small talk.
Any regular radio commands you would hear in the military are often replicated in militia use of walkie-talkie apps.
Yeah, solid copy. That intel you get.
Like solid copy.
Radio check.
Lima Charlie.
To an outsider hearing this kind of talk, it plays into a perception that it's a big LARP. You know, it's a big live action role play. Grown men playing army.
But I think it kind of stops being LARP when the weapons are real.
In the past decade, people associated with far-right militias have plotted to bomb mosques, shot protesters, and kidnapped migrants at the southern border. We found a couple hundred such groups on Zello. Everything from Boogaloo Boys to Proud Boys to outright white nationalists. But the vast majority of such channels belong to 3% or militias. These groups have drawn the media spotlight this year by rallying behind a steady stream of culture war causes. There was the gun rally in Virginia known as Lobby Day.
Gun rights supporters gathered in huge numbers today in Richmond, Virginia. They're protesting a wave of gun control measures being proposed by the newly elected Democrat.
The COVID lockdown protests in Michigan.
As protesters moved into the Capitol building, Democratic State Senator Dania Polhenki posted this photo saying, "Directly above me, men with rifles yelling at us. Some of my colleagues who own bulletproof vests are wearing them."
The Black Lives Matter protests sparked by the murder of George Floyd.
Peaceful protests met by armed men and Confederate flags.
And conspiracy theories of Antifa infiltrating white suburbs.
Stay safe and lock and loaded. That's the warning in this Facebook post made Tuesday afternoon. Police call it a false rumor that claimed Antifa had 3 busloads of members ready to hit neighborhoods in Maumelle.
It's an interesting situation that we find ourselves in where America is heavily armed, right?
Joan Donovan directs research at the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard University.
And there are a lot of folks right now who have been socially isolated for a very long period of time and have been reaching out through social media because they don't know how to assess the risks posed by the pandemic, political environment that we're in, the heightened polarization.
The increased visibility of these armed groups, combined with the anxiety and anger about the news, drove prospective recruits to right-wing forums and Facebook groups where militia guys shared passwords with step-by-step instructions about how to join their Zello channels.
And so you join the group, and then the officers will invite you for an interview. They'll ask you some questions about what area you're in, whatever sort of ideological requirements there are for joining said militia.
What interested you in the 3% movement? Were you heard about the 3%?
I was actually approached in conversation during a anti-protest of Antifa and BLM in Brandon, Mississippi.
Do all of you have the backing of your family? Do they know that you're on an interview tonight?
I'm the man of the house, so, you know, if I need to go somewhere or do something, that's going to happen.
To be clear, neither Hampton nor I ever pretended to be a militia guy or a potential recruit. We merely lurked in the background.
So what do you got? What kind of experience you got? Military, law enforcement, medical?
31 Bravo, military police. I know a lot about weapons, munitions, and a fair amount of gear.
It's like a second job. It's us or tyranny. It's us or failure. It's us or a post-American world. Don't give two shits or a flying about anybody that's less than 100% all the in. Are you all the in, over?
I ain't got nothing holding me back, Trip. If it kills me, it kills me.
And the ways in which those groups come together and do recruitment through platforms really has to do with them unapologetically believing that they can actually become a proxy for law enforcement.
Joan Donovan.
And so I think the continuous engagement with one another through social media has really normalized the notion of the vigilante.
Vigilantes, of course, are not law enforcement. They're not accountable to the public or trained to de-escalate violence. That's why some observers shudder at the thought of armed militias, say, standing guard at polling stations in November. Monitoring Zello, we did hear some references to violence surrounding the election, but it was about how to react to it.
We have to stay vigilant, stay well-trained, and maintain our composure
so that we don't ever fire that first shot. That would kill us.
Yeah, roger that, sir. If we fire the first shot, we're done. I mean, the public view is turning around about us, and that's the way we need to keep it. We don't need to do anything to tarnish that.
They're fantasizing again, and oh, there's going to be all this, you know, riots in the streets. We got to be ready, guys. We got to be ready. But they're not talking about themselves going out there and doing it.
Megan Squire, a professor of computer science at Elon University, has been tracking discussions of the election from far-right groups online.
The whole vigilantism is couched in this language of protection, and that started in earnest with the reopen protests. Oh, I'm going to protect your business from the police who are trying to shut you down. And then it went to George Floyd. Oh, I'm going to protect you from the looters. And it's persisting now. Like, I'm going to protect Trump from election meddling. The idea that this vigilantism is justified from a protection standpoint, youch, that's terrifying. Because now they have a reason, right? And it's a reason that makes them look like a hero.
And then there's this growing body of evidence that some local police departments are enabling it. Hours before Kyle Rittenhouse shot three protesters, killing two in an alleged act of self-defense, he and the Kenosha Guard, a local militia, were thanked by law enforcement. They even offered the vigilantes bottles of water.
We appreciate you guys. We really do. Thank you.
Rittenhouse provides a template for examining how violence might unfold in the coming months. Here was an armed vigilante who used social media to find other armed vigilantes. With the approval of law enforcement, they patrolled the streets looking for conflict. But Rittenhouse was overwhelmed when he found it, and so he shot his way out. For better or worse, police and social media play crucial roles in the likelihood of these scenarios recurring. Let's start with the cops. While listening to Zello, Hampton and I observed three times when militia members claimed they had coordinated with law enforcement. For example, one group, called the Georgia 3% Martyrs, expressed deep distrust of the police in their chat room, but claimed to have teamed up with them at a BLM protest south of Atlanta.
When Payne, Evo, J3, and myself rolled up at South Lake Mall and assisted the Morrow Police Department, we were in full battle rattle, and Payne even sighted in on somebody, and they didn't mess with us.
However, the fact that the police are, you know, allegedly standing next to a militia member who is pointing a rifle and looking down his sights at said protester is highly troubling.
I was interested in this, so I reached out to a reporter named Robin Kemp, who wrote for a website that she started called the Clayton Crescent. She was there at South Lake Mall, and she sent me audio of the scene. Don't shoot! She walked with the protesters, about 150 of them.
Almost all African-American people who were marching. There was no violence or vandalism or anything like that. It was like a very joyful, family-oriented feeling of people assembling for the march in the parking lot of the shopping mall on the weekend.
And it's time that we speak up, we stand up, and we let the world know that Black Lives Matter.
Amen. Was this like the only Black Lives Matter protest at the South Lake Mall over the summer?
Yeah, I think that was the only one.
She did not see very many police officers there, and she did not see any militia guys there. If this did happen, then the police and the militia were out of sight, off to the side.
It's very common for militias to either get on roofs or go around corners and just be staged nearby. There was a Black Lives Matter protest here in Atlanta back in 2016 that I attended. And as I was leaving, I took a wrong turn in the parking garage and ended up on the roof. And two spaces over, there was a Jeep with four men with rifles in their hands looking out over the protest. There's a lot of work that happens that isn't super visible.
It's worth noting, too, that Zello is just one app that militias use for organizing. So I wouldn't have access to their communication on, say, Telegram or Facebook chat. In a written statement, the Georgia 3% Martyrs denied that they were at this event. The Morrow Police Department did not respond to our request for comment. A month after the Morrow protest, I caught wind of another potential police-militia relationship in Georgia.
I got word from Douglas County Sheriff's Department today that they're supposed to have a protest in Douglas County over their monument and Civil War monuments And they said within the next week, they may reach out and ask for assistance.
And if possible, we'll give it.
That's two guys from the 3% security force speaking on July 2nd. 1 week later, there was in fact a Black Lives Matter protest at the Civil War Monument. But we're not sure the 3%ers ever showed up. The 3% security force militia denied that they had contact with the police. The Douglas County Sheriff's Department did not respond to our request for comment. The third example of alleged coordination between armed vigilantes and local police actually reveals a course of action for reducing violence in the future. It involves the Michigan Home Guard, a militia that made national news in May when it defended Carl Mankey, a barbershop owner who defied state lockdown measures by reopening his business.
Members of the Michigan militia say they will take action to keep Mankey from going to jail.
We are willing to stand in front of that door and block the entrance. So, yeah, the police will have no entry there today.
A few weeks later, word begins to spread that there's an upcoming Black Lives Matter protest in the works. A couple local politicians and at least a couple armed militias, including the Michigan Home Guard, are preparing to attend. Then Livingston County Sheriff Michael Murphy posts this video to his department's Facebook page.
So here's the deal. I've had personal conversation with Rob from 2A, Mike Detmer, and former Sheriff Bob Bazat. I asked both to stand down to not show up tomorrow. Let me tell you a little story. Back in the mid-90s, there was a KKK rally held on the steps of the old courthouse. That was the biggest non-event that this county has ever seen. The community really banded together and had other activities to do. A handful of people, maybe 20 at the most, showed up for the KKK to do their thing. They realized that they didn't get the reaction that they were looking for. They packed up and left. So it was a beautiful thing. That said, my plea is if you just stay away, there's no stage for anybody to make this thing go sideways.
That's fascinating.
Isn't that fascinating?
I hadn't seen that.
I think it's a little problematic to like compare the KKK to Black Lives Matter protesters, but I understand the point that he was trying to make, which is that showing up in force in response to something could have the effect of pouring gasoline on the fire.
Yeah, and Michigan has an extensive history with right-wing militias. Referring to these militia as the 2A community is laundering that history through something that is deemed a little bit more politically neutral, a constitutional amendment.
That's a good point. And as I listen to the Michigan Home Guard on Zello kind of making sense of the message from the sheriff, there was some frustration and anger, and I would also say confusion.
So Livingston County Sheriff there requested Michigan Home Guard and other vetted militia groups to come and help him with extra security, and then later came out publicly and said he did not do that. He does not want any 2A people there and then stay away.
There was a rumor that spread in the Michigan Home Guard Zello group that even after he made that video, he secretly said, no, Michigan Home Guard should come.
No, I still want you there. I just want you to stand back and make sure nobody sees you, more or less.
I still want them to come. I basically just want them to keep a low profile.
Well, that's not shady at all.
Pardon me, but that's bull. And, you know, he should have just kept his mouth shut.
The next day, the sheriff posted to Facebook denying this rumor. And again, there's a lot about what happened behind the scenes that we can't verify. But by addressing the militias publicly, asking these groups to not show up, the sheriff seemed to at least annoy them enough to the point that they decided not to go.
Yeah, RLT gave us an official stand down on the Livingston thing.
Sheriff Michael Murphy denied that he was in contact with the militia. The Michigan Home Guard did not respond to our request for comment. We couldn't get a complete picture of what happened in any of these examples, but the tapes demonstrate that local law enforcement wield a ton of influence over local militia activity. The police may either ignore, condone, invite it, or effectively tamp it down. Social media companies face a similar choice. This summer, Facebook deleted thousands of militia pages. Twitter also booted a bunch of militia accounts, as did Discord, a smaller app that has long incubated far-right groups.
We were very concerned about Discord during the rise of the alt-right because Discord was a minor app and it really wasn't able to understand enough about what was happening on its platform. because they would see, oh, you know, it's just 13 people. And that ends up being like Adam Waffen, right? It's a group of people that are coordinating violence.
In the name of white supremacy.
Exactly. And so Zello has to have a procedure and a policy and enforcement mechanisms where they do not tolerate this kind of behavior, unless it's the business model.
You'd think it would be hard for Zello Corporate to miss what's happening on their own platform if Hampton and I alone could locate 200 far-right groups ranging from Oath Keepers to straight-up Nazis. According to Zello's own terms of service, the app can remove anything that, quote, represents promotion of, celebration with, violent extremist ideologies, groups, and tactics. We reached out to the company asking how it was enforcing its terms of service. In a written statement, Zello told us that the company, quote, allows speech protected by the U.S. Constitution and law. Late in our reporting process, we spoke with an employee from Zello, who asked to remain anonymous. The employee sent us a company-wide email from June that detailed some of the militia and white nationalist activity on the app. The employee said that in a subsequent company-wide meeting, Zello CEO Bill Moore said, essentially, that because the platform was not legally responsible for any harm caused by those far-right groups, it would not kick them off the site. Nor would Zello implement new moderation practices to deter this type of organizing in the future. Zello responded to us saying that, quote, the employee's characterization is inaccurate and misleading, end quote. The company confirmed that the most concrete actions to come out of its internal review were to, one, de-index all pages of user-generated content, which includes the far-right stuff, from search engines. So now, when you Google Zello 3% or Zello Nazi, those channels don't show up. But you can still find them by searching on Zello. And two, Zello removed a trending channels feature that may have amplified hate groups. For Zello's full response, go to onthemedia.org. From now until November 3rd, at least, we'll be concerned about the potential for violence around the election. Researcher Megan Squire says her phone has been off the hook.
Probably 5 times today, different reporters, 5 times yesterday, every single day. That's the question that I'm getting.
No one knows the answer. But too much blood has been shed already for any police department or online platform to pretend there was nothing they could have done to help stop it. For On the Media, I'm Michael Loewinger.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Eloise Blondio, with help from Ava Sasani. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Adrian Lilly and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.